Hola, my name is Elias Torres, host of the American Dream Podcast. On this show, I talk to underrepresented founders and seasoned executives who have achieved their versions of the American Dream. We discover their origin stories, their career trajectories, and their biggest lessons learned. On this episode, I talk with Ariel Lopez, founder and CEO of NAC and member of the partnerships team at Techstars. Ariel has had the entrepreneurial mindset from a young age. And on this episode, we discuss why she said no to being a part of former President Obama's campaign, why she dropped out of college and found a career in tech, and how she's creating change through her startup and the venture capital ecosystem today. Ariel has had an inspiring journey, and she's only getting started. Let's get into it. Hello, Ariel. Welcome to the American Dream. So I always like to start by telling us a little bit about yourself or where'd you grow up, right? Yeah, I think you're in Atlanta now, but I don't know if you always were there or not.
I am not an Atlanta native. I actually grew up in North Carolina. I typically say that those were kind of my younger years, and then New York adulted me. So I moved to New York at the age of 20. I moved to Atlanta right before I turned 30. So in my head, New York is still kind of home. But I love Atlanta. I think it has an emerging tech scene. It's a lot of the reason why I moved, on top of, you know, inflation and the economy and wanting to be somewhere a little bit more affordable. But honestly, I am often debating whether or not this is it for me. I don't know if I settle here or not. There may be some future moves, so we'll see.
I don't know. You made me kind of sad. You're like, this is it. I'm like, there's only so much okra I can handle, like on one trip to Atlanta. You know? Tell us a little bit more growing up. How was it? So North Carolina, I interrupted you. What was the dynamic there? What did you learn? What values did you learn growing up with your family?
Yeah, I think growing up in North Carolina as someone that is Black and Latina was quite interesting. So half of my family is Puerto Rican, but I would call them New Yorkicans. So, you know, in New York, Puerto Ricans are everywhere. In North Carolina, not so much. So I think that there was a little bit of an identity struggle growing up, right? And just convincing people like, hey, I'm actually not Mexican. I'm a blend of all of these things, even though you don't see it. But grew up in a single parent home, a lot of love for my mother. I think my work ethic and a lot of my perspective and how I view the world honestly comes from her. Was always very outspoken. I think in my probably like middle school to high school years, I was involved in student government. I was always leading some type of initiative. In high school, I came up with my first idea to start a business. At the time, I wanted to create a teen center and kind of model it after the Y, because there wasn't a lot for youth in the area. I also had a love for politics. So pre-college, I actually started interning for Obama's campaign my senior year in high school. So this was 2008. I gathered all of the seniors to go and vote for the first time. So that was a monumental moment. And yeah, I think I was one of those people that knew I'm bigger than where I am, right? And I had a lot of ambition. I just didn't know how it was going to unfold at that time. So fast forward, once I got into college, I actually got invited to go on the campaign trail for Obama full time. But I was like, I'm actually starting my freshman year. So
you're like, Obama, no thanks. Cool story, bro. No, can't do it.
Yeah, not so much. But you know, it was.
But you did tell him no.
Well, I didn't tell him no verbatim. And I don't know if Obama.
You're like, call me maybe.
Please call me and please come back because we need you. But it influenced a lot of my early years in college. So I was a political science major at the time. I was thinking I was going to go to law school. I was going to move to the Hill, become a lobbyist. Like, I just was convinced that I had this career in law. And then I started doing more and more research on the system, and I won't go down that rabbit hole today, but
tell me one thing, like the system works or doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And I think we are realizing why it does not work in real time. But ultimately I felt like I wasn't going to be able to have the impact that I wanted to, if I went that route. I also had started a nonprofit organization in college. So I always had that entrepreneurial bug. The nonprofit was essentially to help people that came from underserved communities get access to resources that they needed to gain success in whatever it is that they were trying to do. So I was working with city council. I was working with local business owners. I was working with students on campus. And I think I realized whatever I end up doing, I may not need my degree to do it. I also had a wave of friends that were graduating from college, moving back home with your parents, graduating from college, going to work at Best Buy or going to work at Target. And again, like my freshman year was 2008. So, you know, we're talking about the recession or the impending recession, but we lived through that one. So I think there was a reckoning of maybe this is not what I should be doing. And maybe there's an alternate path for me to take. Yeah. So that led me to dropping out of college my junior year. I moved to New York and that was it.
I love that, right? I think in a way I had a much more limited view. I think you had, I love what you said, right? Is that you always knew you were meant for something bigger, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that we need to nurture more in kids. I think that is something precious, right? Sometimes I just like, you know, my son, my youngest just walked through here. He hasn't done his homework probably, right? But it's like, as parents, what we dream of is that spark, that motivation, right? That desire of a kid to have a dream or to want to do something. So if they're playing with the lemonade stand, like how do we got to encourage those things. And so
yeah.
I love that you had that and that you went for it, you know, many times and trying that.
It's interesting that when you think about our communities, we're almost risk adverse in that way. Right.
I wouldn't say just our community. Everybody's risk averse.
Yeah.
It's like if you're white, wealthy, suburban, well-educated, whatever it is, they're still risk averse. They're just more comfortable with higher risk.
Yeah.
Because they're like comfortable. Doesn't mean they take more risk. Like in general, humans don't like to take risks. It's taking risks. It's meant to be scary, right?
It is.
It's an unknown. It could be a failure. Like who wants to fail, right?
Yeah. Like,
nobody wants to fail.
Until you decide to be an entrepreneur. But
well, we do things risky because if you really know how bad the failure rates is, you wouldn't do it. I think the people that do it is because they're like, no, I'm going to succeed. And they're like, no, idiot, everybody fails. It's like 99.99, right? But that's the beauty of it, that we don't die if we try something, right? We learn from it. And then maybe after so many failures, boom, you get a success, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
That's what it is. It's just simply trying and surviving through those things. And it's just what makes it fun, right?
Yeah. Resilience is critical. But
I also like about, sorry to interrupt, but it's like, I love that you went and said, you did so many little pivots, right? And you're like, a lot of people stress out, what am I going to study? Did it matter what you studied to what you're doing now?
No, it did not.
I mean, I'm sure it influenced, it's knowledge that you had, but it at the end, it's not a one for one. Second, are you happy with what you're doing?
Well, yeah, exactly.
And so, what I'm saying, we got to encourage people, right? Because people are like, stressed out. Am I making the right decision? Am I choosing the right career? With AI now, what should I study? It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite things is to talk to college students and people that are earlier in their career. And I remember I gave a talk at Princeton and there was a student in the audience and she was interested in working in social media. And she was like, I just don't know if tech is the right industry for me. And I asked her what she wanted to do. And then she told me, and I was like, you know, there's thousands of jobs available today, right? And I always bring that up because if the Princeton grad is confused as to what their options are, imagine what that looks like for the community college students and imagine what it looks like for the students that dropped out. I think I got incredibly lucky on my journey. When I moved to New York, my first role was working with an agency, and I was essentially a recruiter for sales executives. That led me to working for another staffing firm that specialized in digital media and startups. So at that time, my clients were PayPal and Amazon and Living Social back when that was a thing, right? So I'm looking at these roles and, you know, I'm doing 100 cold calls a day, trying to find people for these opportunities. And I think there was just an awareness of like, oh, wow, there's so much to do within tech that I didn't know about. And then I think that became part of my purpose. Like, how can I give more people access to these types of opportunities? How can we dismantle some of the barriers that exist to entry? And being a recruiter at the time, you know, I was maybe 21, 22, and I'm talking to the Harvard grads. I'm talking to the people that are $200,000 in student loan debt trying to get an entry-level position in New York for like $50,000 a year. And we all know what that looks like, right? So I'm like, man, something is broken here. And the only thing that I think has changed is I think there's probably more access now than there was back then. So Google, you know, didn't have apprenticeship programs and they weren't popping up on your campus. Like, I talk to students now and I'm like, you guys are so lucky because the tech companies are here. They care. You have access to venture. I wasn't even familiar with the venture space until I became a founder. So I think back.
What year was this? What year?
This was, so I took the leap officially in 2016, and I'll talk more about what that journey looked like. Made a lot of different pivots, raised some money, turned down $1 million term sheet. That's a fun story. But in between, you know, going through all of my struggles as a founder, you become immersed in having conversations with VCs, at least if you want to raise venture capital. So you know the ins and outs of what they're looking for, how to pick the right investors, thinking about what your exit strategy is going to be, all of those things. So I think I always saw working in venture as something I would do later in my career, maybe in like my late 40s, early 50s, starting a fund, something along those lines. It just so happened to where I'm kind of working in venture now, so we can talk more about
it. What do you mean you're kind of working? You are in venture.
But I am, yeah. But it's, but I bring that up because if I were to go back to my time as a student, you know, I had no idea that venture capital was even a thing. And a lot of funds now have apprenticeship programs. You have programs like HBCU VC, where they're connecting HBCU students to venture funds and different opportunities in tech. So I'm actually just really happy to see the progress that's been made. Yeah. I know it's easy to look around and say, everything is still messed up and we have a long way
to go. Yeah, you're the first positive one that I talked to. Everybody's like, you know what percentage? Less than 1%.
Yeah, well, the metrics still aren't that great, but I do think there's more access and I think there's certainly more visibility around the industry today than there was, let's say, 10 years ago.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think that's part of why I put the podcast here, like, and not trying to say that this is the most popular podcast in the world, but and we're putting this, right, is that for the one that is seeking, they can find this information and the encouragement, right, that things are better. You can walk up and get introductions to any VC firm, and you can learn about having those conversations, tap into people, and take a swing at getting some money, right? And you know, making that pitch, just incubator programs. Tell me a little bit about what your company was. What were you trying to do? I want to know what a hustler, caller, outbound, a recruiter, agency person said. I want to build a company.
Oh man, I mean, those days were chaotic to say the least, and I saw a lot of adversity throughout that time. But essentially, I was, you know, working on the staffing agency side. So for anyone that's unfamiliar, you have external recruiters, and this is what they would call headhunters. And then you have internal recruiters. And I think the running joke is anyone that's an internal recruiter, not that your life isn't hard, but it's probably a little bit easier, right? It's not as salesy as being a headhunter, quote unquote. But I knew that the thing that I loved the most was helping people navigate from A to B in their careers. So during that time, I ended up meeting one of my former colleagues named Eddie, and he worked at a company called General Assembly. And GA was one of the first disruptors within education. Essentially, the premise was you don't have to go to college, you don't have to have a four-year degree to grow your career in tech. And for a college dropout, I was like, yeah, that's me all day. Like, I love it. And he was like, well, we're looking for career coaches. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. Like, I've been recruiting this entire time. I never thought about becoming a coach. I didn't even know you could have a job as a coach, right? And then I got to GA, and it was so instrumental in just not even my career, but also my life, right? Like, being a coach, it forces you to step outside of yourself and see the best in other people. And I think GA had a really unique environment in which my students weren't 18 to 20 year olds. My students were 40 year olds that had mortgages and worked at hedge funds and decided that they hated their lives in finance and they didn't want to do it anymore. And they wanted to do something creative in tech. So whether that was learn UX design or become a product manager or become an engineer, I remember rolling out our first data analytics course, like when that was popular, right? So I'm coaching all of these people and I'm seeing them transition into the space and find jobs. And I think it just was a lesson for me in what was possible. And I became really passionate about wanting to help as many people make that transition as I could. So before I left GA, I started an event series called Office Hack. Essentially, it was a, instead of a bar crawl, it was a crawl of tech companies in New York. So
We're drinking.
There was some drinks on different stops, yes.
And if they had a beer fridge, you guys just like raid it?
Well, that's the thing, right? Like if you think of like the glory days in tech, all of these companies have amazing offices, but also like their cafeterias, right? Like Facebook.
Wait, we're not in the glory days of tech?
They still exist. Like I was at South By a few weeks ago and I had a chance to go to Google's office in Austin and their cafeteria. I go to their office pretty often in Atlanta as well. So they're always going to have an amazing cafeteria. Their office is always going to have some cool stuff happening. But at the time, that wasn't really a thing, right? So it was like, can we bring out 100 people and have them hop from company to company so they could meet with hiring managers and recruiters and just learn more about what these opportunities would be for them. And the first crawl we had, oh my God, we had Mashable, we had Yelp, we had Google. I think the second one we had MasterCard, we had Spotify, we had Uber, like we just had companies coming in And GA actually sponsored the first series.
Right.
I think important note was I had an idea. I tested it before I quit GA. So once I had an inkling of like, okay, I can monetize this in some way by getting those sponsors, that gave me enough of a reason to think like I can make this into a thing. The other piece of that is I met my first investor. And this is more of a cautionary tale, but I'll throw it in anyway. I did a panel with someone and they followed up with me. They worked with a really old staffing firm in New York. And they said, hey, I think if you're looking for money, I may have someone that's interested in investing. I had a couple of meetings with them. This is before I quit officially. And they said, yeah, like we'll put in the money, but it was a very roundabout way of doing things. Like I had an LLC. Anyone that's in tech knows that is not favorable if you want to raise money down the line. So I had to transition to an S corp. Like I had to do all of the dirty legal things after the fact. We made an agreement to where I was willing to give up 30% of the company in exchange for that investment, something that I would never do. And I always tell founders, like, be careful when it comes to the terms, right? So I essentially had to buy out his stake of the company once we parted ways. But if I didn't have the funding and if we didn't do like those pre-sales, I probably would have stuck around at GA for at least another year or two, right? Yeah. And at this point, I'm 25. So I think it's important to bring that up too. When you think about the successful founders in tech, they're not really in their 20s. I know it's sexy.
Come on. You know, everybody wants to be like, I was making a big argument with somebody who says that Steve Jobs, Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, they were all first-time founders and young, right? So everybody likes it. So I think the argument is, because I'm old, so I like to say the old, I love your, like, the quote is like, successful founders are like, start like at 42.
Yeah. You know?
But the thing about it is that, but the amount of successful first-time founders is more, I forget what it was, but I'm like, people just want to fight over this. Experience is good.
And I bring that up, right? Because I was in such a rush. And I think we live in a society that obviously is fueled by capitalism. So that plays a role. But there's this idea that you're running out of time, that there isn't enough time, that you have to do it today. If I could go back, I probably would have spent a little bit more time at GA. And I don't think people recognize like the work that you're doing is additive.
Exactly.
Me, you know, I ended up starting an HR tech company. So working at an ed tech company, having a background in HR and recruiting, I had that domain expertise. So it was a lot easier for me to at least have an idea of what the product roadmap would be in the early days. I wasn't completely spinning my wheels, but I also didn't take full advantage of some of the resources. For example, GA had free courses for their employees. I didn't take any classes. I don't know how to code. So like I'm a non-technical founder and everyone knows that's a bit of a challenge.
But now you have AI, you don't have to worry about it.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I mean, before the increase of AI, it's always been preferred if you're not coding yourself, then you have a CTO right alongside of you that's very strong in that area. So I think back to, you know, not fully taking advantage of being able to grow my technical acumen. Like I could have learned how to code for free from some of the best people in the industry, right? The other piece of that is making sure that you're leveraging relationships. And luckily, like there's I'm in like maybe 1,000 Slack channels, but there is a Slack channel for GA alumni, so many alumni, and this is not the students of GA, but employees. Are now founders, have venture funds, like all of us are in the industry just doing really cool things, right? Yeah. So I think back to that, like when I was building my team, maybe I should have reached across to someone that I was already working with and said, hey, I want to do this thing. Do you want to build it with me? And I think when you look at the success rate of startups, a lot of them have that fabric of we met at work, we were doing something we were passionate about, we felt like we could do it better. Yep. So we left, and now we're building this new thing. And obviously, I have all of this knowledge now, many years later. But back then, I was just in a rush to take the leap and go out on my own.
Yeah, but I love everything that you're saying. I mean, you just gave a master class, right, on advice on how to start a company and what you leverage that you might ignore or not be aware that you have, right? But I was recruiting someone to my company today. Person has had some major successes and some ups and downs, and you know, sometimes you pick the wrong company.
Yeah.
And I was like, look, no, I'm not discounting that. Don't worry about that. I'm actually valuing those lessons, because everything that you did and went as a founder teaches you so much that if you've never been a founder, you're not going to be able to appreciate or recognize or understand me, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or where I'm coming from. We are who we are, and that accumulation of experiences is what increases the odds of us doing this over and over until we achieve our dream, right?
Yeah. 1,000%.
Yeah. No, I love that. No, but I mean, I think, again, I think what I respect so much out of you is the, I now overuse the word agency, is your agency, right? To choose to go try those things. That is priceless, right? Whether you succeed or fail, doesn't matter. You're accumulating experience. And now that you know, you're still young. And so it's like you could be 30, you could be 40, you could be 50, you could be start. I'm 49, I'm starting a new company, right? And it's like, it's super fun. It's super fun when you have more experience and you're older. It's like, yeah. It's like this is different. This is not like having a baby. You know what I mean? This is like completely like OP, you know, style. Like, it's like, this is much easier. This is much more fun than the first times, because I was clueless. Yeah.
When we were talking about age, one person came to mind, and that's Stuart Butterfield. And I always talk about his story because obviously we know Slack, we use Slack, but Slack was not an overnight success. Slack was actually something else. It was a portion of a failed product that they had.
Hold on, Slack was an overnight success.
Well, once it became that, right? Yeah. But the reality is they were building something else.
Absolutely.
For, I believe, maybe 2 or 3 years. And they ended up shutting down.
The audio? What's it?
I forget the name.
It was a gaming platform.
Yes. Yep. And essentially, they decided to keep the messaging function because that was the stickiest part of what they were building. And that is what they turned into Slack.
Yeah, I was this close of building Slack myself while Stuart was doing Flickr, right? I was already in startups. And so like my first job at IBM was building chatbots in 99. Mm. Then I built wikis. Then I built blogs. And then we had like this messaging stuff, like a Facebook, like a chatter. So I grew up with all this messaging in my career. And then at Lookery, we were using, Basecamp, Campfire. It's a 37 signals, how to chat, like a Slack thing, you know? And then we started using HipChat that got bought by Atlassian. And so when I was at HubSpot, leaving HubSpot to start a company, my first project was a Slack. Like, I was literally building Slack.
Yeah, that's so funny.
And so like, and then as I'm coding it, the same view that you see today, right? Channels, box thing. There was one called Le Chat or something. There was something from France that was like really good looking. Mm. And then there was Slack came out. And we were like, And the Slack just came out with that amazing design. And we were like, too late. We missed it. Because HipChat got bought by Atlassian and then just went to shit.
Yeah.
And so like we, David and I just had such a passion because we just always built our companies with a shared chat that most companies at that time were not using. They were just emailing back and forth.
Yeah.
Or you would use Skype or you would use something like that, right? So So
Skype days.
Skype days. I have a clear memory of all those days. And then, so then I had to pivot to build Drift, which was a chatbot, you know, because what we built was not, the Slack part, like just took off like wildfire. It was like, there's no way we catch that thing up.
Yeah, I love that. It's just so interesting to think of the evolution, right, over the years. But, you know, thinking of Slack, thinking of Stuart, he's another one. He was older when Slack came to be.
Yeah.
I forget how old he is now, but it's just an example of someone that kind of earned their stripes in the industry first and mm-hmm. then found success a little bit later. So for anyone that's listening, you are exactly where you're supposed to be. I think my biggest piece of advice is just, how can you leverage the experiences that you've had and build upon them?
Yeah, I think that the big things is, it's never too late. Everything that you're doing is a lesson and a learning.
Yeah.
And the most important is to figure out when to seize the moment, right?
Yeah.
When to go for it, and just prepare as best as you can. Like grab all your assets and experiences and just go do it.
Yeah.
It's never going to be enough, but you got to go do it, right? It's just going to dictate the likelihood of the outcome, but it gets smaller over time, you know. Definitely the time doesn't run out. Only if we're dead, you know, but then it doesn't matter.
Yeah, this is true.
Bendito, bendito. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about... you did that. I have here some of my notes here that something about NAC. What is NAC?
Yeah. So when I left GA, I did things offline for maybe 2 to 3 years. So I mentioned the tech crawl that we were hosting. I actually created my own version of a boot camp, but it was only for underrepresented individuals, and we only had educators. And teachers that came from underrepresented backgrounds. Like, I know we're anti D&I now, but back then, like, I was the poster child for D&I. So I was doing everything that I could just to make it unique and meaningful for the community that I come from and the people that I represent. I think what I recognize, though, is you can do things offline, but for so long before you become burnt out. So this was 2018 going into like 2019. I was like, we need to build a product. I ended up meeting my co-founder at the time, who hailed from JP Morgan. Still have a good relationship with him, but I think that's another cautionary tale. When you're looking at your co-founder, you may want to find someone that comes from a startup, because, you know, life looks a lot different. You're not going to have the same type of stability that you would get.
I came from IBM.
Well, yeah, exactly. So you know what it looks like. Well, I think everyone is built a little bit differently, yeah. But at the time, he became our chief product officer. He had gone to a couple of office hacks and different events. So he was just a support of what I was trying to build. And at the time, we had the idea to improve how people were being assessed. So one of the things that I loved about GA, and I think any boot camp that is decent, they're going to have you do project work, right? Like, you're working on real life examples for these companies to prove whether or not you actually have the skills to do the job. Yeah. So essentially, we wanted to productize that. So NAC in the early days would have been more so similar to HackerRank. And I don't know if they're still around or not. But essentially, it was an assessment tool and it was built as a marketplace. So we had job seekers on one side, companies on the other. The job seekers would complete some type of sample work, and then the company would review it and then decide whether or not they wanted to move them through their interview
process. Yeah, no, makes sense. Makes total sense.
It does make sense. However, real feedback, by the way, StubHub was one of our beta customers, and one of the recruiters sent me an email, and he was like, is there any way you can make it faster for us to reject people? And I was like, actually, that's kind of the opposite of what we were hoping you would do here. And I think we recognized, you know, our heart was in the right place. It was always about making things easier for the job seeker, because we know you're not always going to be judged for the right reasons.
Right.
And your resume doesn't even always get seen. That's ultimately what led to the pivot and kind of Knack 2.0. But essentially, we took those learnings and we were like, all right, we're not going to do a marketplace. This is going to be B2B. And if the companies aren't going to do the things that we want them to do, we need to build the tech to make it easier for them to move in the direction that we want them to go, right? So StubHub, if you want to reject more people, how about instead of you going through the applicants, Knack goes through the applicants, right? So we wanted to automate the screening to where we're doing the screening, we're making recommendations to the company based off of our findings. And this is where AI comes into play. And then from a job seeker perspective, it's how do we make sure that your resume doesn't get lost in this ATS, which is an applicant tracking system, after you apply? I jokingly call it the black hole because that's basically what it is.
Yeah. I almost never hire anyone that applied.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, and I have so many stories around that. Like I mentioned Google. I have friends that work at Google that got interviewed their third or fourth time applying because the first three times they got auto rejected. From personal experience, I remember applying to Tumblr for a sales recruiter role, and I didn't get it. And I was like, there's no way these people looked at my resume and told me no, because I had been hiring salespeople the entire time. Fast forward 2 years later, I'm on a panel and someone in the audience finds me afterwards, and she's from Tumblr, and she's like, I loved everything that you said on the panel. We think what you're doing is great. And I wanted to tell her, well, if you think I'm so great, you should have hired me when I applied, right? So it's not always on you, meaning the job seeker. It's literally the system.
Absolutely.
And that's what I have to try to educate people around.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when you apply, if you get ghosted, if you get that auto rejection within like 3 seconds of you applying,
wow,
no one ever looked at your resume, right? It was just automatically discarded. So I think the premise of Knack was like, how can we use tech for good to honestly improve a system that's been broken for quite some time, create some type of equity in this process where it's extremely lacking, but also improve productivity for the company. Because when you think of a recruiter, and now I'm speaking from my past life, I could want to give feedback to 100 people. I don't have time for that. So a lot of those mass rejections, and it's all canned, like, we're sorry to inform you, we're going in another direction, and no one ever tells you what that means. It's because there's no time to tell you what it means.
Yeah.
And I probably never even saw your resume to begin with. So that is the problem that we wanted to tackle.
Oh, I love the passion, and it's only going to get worse, right? Because companies are getting smaller. And,
yeah.
And so now there's the same number, or if not more, of applicants, smaller teams. It's still a big problem. It's still a big problem.
It's still a very big problem.
Yeah. No, but I love the passion, right? I think that is something, I know there's a stereotype says that Latinos are like, we end up caring more. It's like we have social good in us, and I want to careers of the stuff.
Yeah.
And you've been like, I want to sell the underrepresented, underserved, the minorities, the activists, the this, and it is beauty. But I like how you've been blended in with tech and recruiting, and that's the beauty. You know, you're taking a path, and you keep doing the more of that, and now you're at TechStars. Tell us about TechStars.
even getting to Techstars was quite interesting. So with NAC, we had some success, right? So we raised money. We were a recipient of a grant from Google. They have a Black Founders Fund. They now have a Latinos Founders Fund, but that did not exist when we first got in. We went through an accelerator that was not Techstars. And while I was in the process of fundraising for our seed round, I ended up getting a term sheet, and everyone knows that's the golden ticket as a founder. Like, you give your firstborn to get a term sheet. And it was for over $1 million. It would have given us what we needed to get the runway that we needed to grow. But the terms were predatory, and they were honestly just awful.
Yeah.
And that was one of the hardest decisions I ever had to make, was just like, how do you turn down that amount of money? You know, it's different when it's staring at you on paper versus you just like dreaming it up in your head, right?
VCs give me their first child so that I take their term sheet.
Yeah. Well, yeah, right. That's the flip. But I think I recognized I can't do this deal. Like, we talked about Steve Jobs, and, you know, I have a lot of respect for what he built, and I miss the old Apple. But people often don't talk about what happened to Steve Jobs at Apple. There was a little something called Lisa. So Steve Jobs actually got forced out of Apple at one point. He went on to start a competitor called Lisa, and then they had to beg him to come back. But essentially, if you don't have the right people, if you don't have the right investors, if you don't have the right board, you can get screwed very easily as CEO. And I found myself in a position to kind of foreshadowing, if we had a down quarter, if we didn't hit our numbers, what would that mean for me? Would I now be at the table with a group of individuals that didn't believe in me and would try to out me? And I just wasn't willing to do that. And that was a big reason why I ended up turning it down. But at the time, you know, the market was changing as well. Like, and the market is still pretty rough for founders. Now, if we're talking years, this is like 2022, 2023. I knew that we would probably bootstrap for a little while, and I wanted to be really, really picky about who was going to come onto the cap table.
Yeah.
So 2023, you know, inflation is still going up and we still have to live. And this is just life as a founder, especially if you're bootstrapping. If you're not doing anything else outside of the business, it gets really hard to sustain your lifestyle. And I was stubborn for what, almost 7 years at that point. Like, I refused to touch anything outside of NAC. Like, I am a startup founder. That was my identity. And I just wasn't going to do
it. So you're not stubborn anymore? You're not stubborn anymore?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think I've become maybe a little bit more lenient over time. But I also recognized that I believe you're put in different positions, sometimes just to be a vessel of sorts. Like, it's not always about you. So I ended up having a conversation with someone that works for the city of Atlanta. And essentially, I was told that the mayor, and this is still true, Mayor Dickens is very bullish about turning Atlanta into a top five tech hub. So they wanted someone that could come in essentially as a SME and help them figure out tech and innovation strategy for the city. And I was like, oh, well, this sounds interesting, right? Like, I have my experience as a founder. I know the challenges and the struggles of a founder. Like, maybe I can start working in this world as an ecosystem builder, as I would call it. So I did that for about a year, ended up, you know, helping you,
serving the community always.
Serving the community always. It will always be a part of my story. And I agree with you. I think that social good, and when I talk to young founders that have a focus on social impact or diversity, I'm always very honest and transparent about with them with how that can get viewed in the market. So make sure that you're solving a big enough problem to where people still want to give you money. And it doesn't sound like this is just some nonprofit organization. But I think for me, I'm just a purpose-driven person. So the reality is, if I don't think I'm making a difference, I'm not touching it. I'm just literally not spending any of my time or energy on it, right? But working with the city, I ended up creating a program in partnership with Wells Fargo. It's their first program for startups. And it was $1 million fund, essentially, to give startup loans. It was a grant that looks like a loan to founders. And I've met a few of the founders that were recipients of those loans. And, you know, just hearing their stories of how their lives changed. There was one founder that was really close to shutting down. And I know what that looks like when you're out of runway, right? And you just need a little bit of padding, or maybe you're doing an extension before you raise your next round. Like, I get the dynamics, and I just want to get as much capital and as much resources to founders as possible. But I mentioned that because that was kind of the proof that I needed. Like, okay, I can actually create a program for founders and have successful outcomes. I also knew working with public sector is not my thing. So if we go back to 18-year-old Ariel, right? This is how everything is cyclical. And I'm like, there's a reason why I didn't go to law school. And there's a reason why I don't deal with you people.
But you keep doing it.
Inadvertently. But I ended up parting ways.
You're like, irregardless.
And then top of 2024, I was kind of looking at, you know, myself in the mirror. I'm like, okay, what are we doing? Like, obviously NAC is still a passion. We want to get NAC to an exit, but we also know it may take a little bit longer. And I have this experience now advocating for founders. And I remember having a conversation with one of my colleagues named Joe, who also is Latinx. And we are like one of, I think we're like the only two on the partnerships team, actually. So representation. And I had a conversation with him. And I was like, what does partnerships mean for Techstars? Like, I'm curious. And he told me, you know, we're working with corporate VCs, we're working with colleges and universities, working with government entities and agencies, anyone that really cares about building the innovation economy. And we're actually creating the accelerator programs that you see. We're working with the partners to structure these deals. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting to me, right? Like, I can spin up, let's say, 100 more of these programs like I did with Wells Fargo, just doing it with different partners and different people within the ecosystem. And ultimately, that is how I got to Techstars. And I think it's funny because as a founder, one would assume I went through Techstars, yeah, right? So to have never gone through the accelerator, but now be in a position to where I'm helping to create the accelerators and the programs of the future, you know, again, it's just one of those, yeah, I'm here because I'm supposed to be here.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, I think that YC and Techstars, obviously two of the most successful incubators. It's a very difficult thing, you know, of how to promote entrepreneurship, and everybody's trying to create that all around the world. And it's very hard to replicate. You know, I remember Techstars from the days in the bunkers, in the bunker in Boulder. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I've been there. That was 2008. I was there. When I was starting that company, when I left IBM, I was there with Dave and with I forget the name of the guy with the thick glasses, Foundry,
Brad,
yeah. And so it's like people with the vision and people with the commitment to really democratize this, because it's really hard for people without experience to get the right investors, right?
1,000%.
Yeah.
1,000%.
I love what you're doing. I love what you've done. I love your career. I love your path, your arc. And it's something for people to see, because there's not one road, one path that gets you to a place where you're happy and you feel like you're a accomplishing what you're doing. And this is just a training ground for your next thing. You know what I mean? With the connections that you have now, with the experience that you have in companies, cap tables, like you start over, you race, you're going to get the right terms. You know how to push back. You know how to negotiate, set the preferences, set the posts, the pre's, the pulls, and be able to do something that's going to allow you to accomplish the mission that you go. And now you know how to pick markets, and now you know how to pick co-founders and so forth, right? And so, leave the audience with a good piece of advice or a call to action. What would you say to them?
That's a good question.
I should have prepared you more.
Honestly, I will quote my therapist. And
that's good.
It's fresh in my mind. But the advice would be to focus on the process. Don't focus on the outcome.
Yeah.
I feel like that's really hard to do when we are obsessed with instant gratification, right? And if we're thinking about being a founder, or honestly just being anyone that is a builder or a dreamer, it's easy to hyper-fixate on those very specific milestones, those very specific goals that you're looking to achieve. And if you don't check the box by X date, then you know, you're a failure, so to speak, or you didn't hit your goal, when in reality, you're actually progressing and you're doing so much more than what you think you are, but it's because of your view, right?
It takes a while to get there. I think I've unlocked, you know, level 11 or whatever. The it's like I'm able to remind myself that every day, right? This is my fifth startup.
And that would be my other piece of advice. Like, do it for the love. And if you find yourself in a position to where you have fallen out of love for whatever reason, just know that that spark will come back again and you can fall back in love with whatever it is that you're building, or you can be inspired to build something else. But the story doesn't just end. It continues on.
Exactly. No, I agree. Thank you so much. Nice to meet you. Love what you're doing, and people should reach out to you, especially if they want to learn more about TechStars, if there's their first time.
Yeah, for sure.
Very reputable organization, and just plain advice to come to you as a founder or wannabe founder, so you can help them with that push, that kick, especially if they're a Latina woman, you know, or Latino or Black immigrant, whatever. If they see something, a connection, and they recognize and connect with you, they should.
I would say connect with me on LinkedIn. I have, what, I think over 10,000 connections on LinkedIn. If you're someone that isn't ready to start a business yet, and maybe you're still looking for a job, the majority of my connections are recruiters because of my past life. So that should be beneficial. But with TechStars and my connections in venture, I am connected to a lot of different investors, so I'm happy to point you to people that I know are reputable. For TechStars, applications just opened for our fall program, and we also increased our check size to $220,000. Super favorable terms, honestly, the best that I've seen, and I would also argue in the market today. So definitely look at that, and I'm happy to help support however I can.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the American Dream Podcast. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss when a new episode drops every other Tuesday.